Everybody, welcome to another episode of the OIG Roundtable. We're here today to talk part two of the OIG's unimplemented recommendations. As always, with my partners in crime, Wade McFall, retired assistant special agent in charge from the Los Angeles field office, and now a manager on our SLU investigative team, and of course, batting, I would say cleanup, but there's only three of us, so it's not really cleanup, but batting cleanup, Matt Kachansky, retired special agent in charge from the OIG and the retired Northeast UPIC director and our senior director of our payment integrity team, overseeing all of our SIU operations. Many hats, Matt Kachansky. So today we want to, you know, last week we talked about kind of overall the unimplemented recommendations from the OIG. They've been looking at this stuff. We've seen, you know, since 2017, we've seen a couple of thousand unimplemented recommendations. Take a little bit of a deeper dive on that, and you see that since 2017, it looks like there's over $13 billion, with a B, dollars, in unimplemented recommendations that if all of those recommendations were put in place, $13 billion in savings would have come through HHS programs. That $13 billion, by the way, is not just for CMS. It is not just for Medicare. It's through the entirety of the organization. HHS has over 300 what they call OPDIVs, or operating divisions, and those 300 programs are all looked at by the OIG. And so when you look at a lot of these unimplemented recommendations, they don't always result in an overpayment or an analysis or anything specific to CMS, Medicare, or Medicaid. It can involve some other things. But we're going to focus today on three unimplemented recommendations that were put out. They're kind of, you know, small to large. But the, you know, the big thing in these unimplemented recommendations really has to do with what we'll call coordination of benefits or duplicate payment analyses and things of that sort. So wait, there's two out there that kind of stood out to me that, you know, we talked a little bit about. And one has to do with essentially duplicate payments for VA people, whether, you know, TRICARE or it could be VA care. But this duplicate payment issue is $128 million in duplicate payments over a five-year period where there were payments that were made by both the VA and by Medicare for the same services. So these are interesting because these are double billing cases that from the HHS OIG perspective, we would never see unless you're working with a VA OIG agent or you're requesting VA billing histories where you see this duplicate payment issue. And similarly, there was another one, Wade, which was a little over $953 million, which has to do within the program, double payments, a Part D payment that's made at the same time that a patient is in a skilled nursing facility or a SNF. And so the first one, we look at interagency, meaning VA and HHS, right? A lot of that is essentially it's a coordination of benefits issue. In this case, Medicare is the secondary payer, and it's something, you know, you could look at. There's a lot of stuff out there on what they call MSP, Medicare Secondary Payer. There's a whole set of policies and guidance on that. It becomes very, very unique, and it becomes very twisty and very complicated, particularly when you're talking about Medicare as a secondary payer for example, personal injury cases, people getting a car accidents where there may be other liability. And we don't want to get too deep into the weeds, but there is a coordination of benefits. I've always been amazed at the fact that the Medicare program doesn't always have all of that detail, but other payers do, because when Medicare is the secondary payer on things, or Medicare is the primary and other insurance is the secondary, you have to put that on your CMS 1500 when you submit it. And then with regard to the double payments, you know, when people go into a skilled nursing facility or are inpatient in a hospital, the payment that is made, the per diem payment or the DRG payment, contemplates the cost of care for that patient, inclusive of items, services, and procedures. And we saw this on some other cases involving durable medical equipment where people were in the hospital or at skilled nursing facilities, and there was separate DME that was being provided and then therefore being paid, and duplicate payments were going out. But Wade, what it really shows, both from an interagency perspective and intra-agency, and I think when it's intra-agency, the hair on our neck gets raised up a little bit more because you're thinking in terms of, you know, the information is there. Like this, it's our, we'll call it our, it's CMS, it's Medicare data, or, you know, whatever it may be. So the question always becomes like, how is this even a possibility? But it certainly does show the fact that from an investigative perspective, and we're talking obviously very specifically in the OIG space, particularly when you're talking about these coordination cases, why it is important to have relationships with other agencies, but also why, you know, the challenges exist, right? When agencies don't share data, you have these duplicate payment systems that are out there. And as a result of those duplicate payment systems that are out there, money is being spent that shouldn't be spent.
Right. And you nailed down the key element between these two studies is it's all data related, but, you know, we often talk on these podcasts about, does the data lie to you or does the data not lie to you? And I think in this case, we're just trying to show, if you really boil it down to a simple factor, is one, you know, is CMS paying for the same claim that VA is? And in that case, I feel like the data really doesn't lie, as long as you have both sides of the data. And that means you have to have access to it, first of all. And as you said, if it's intra agency, you need to be working with, for example, in this case, the VA. It would be an HHS OIG plus a VA agent working together. So you need that access. It has to be accurate, and you have to have algorithms to compare the certain data points, which in these cases, it would probably be the date of service. So you can have that overlap and show that this claim was paid for by CMS, so VA shouldn't have paid it, or vice versa. The difficulty, even within HHS, as you alluded to, is there's a lot of difficulty in just getting claims data fields to match, whether it be a Part D and a Part A claim, or, you know, even more difficult is the CMS versus the VA. So you have the intra versus interagency. So in these cases, that's where having the coder or the data scientist who understands not only the issues that have been brought up in these studies, where there's duplicate payments, but also having the ability to basically run the data and compare the data and make edits to the data so that you can compare apples to apples and oranges to oranges. So that value of a coder or a data scientist is, you know, we talk about pennies on the dollar, what we're paying versus what we're getting in return. The value of somebody that understands the data and is able to write that code and those algorithms is invaluable in these types of cases.
Well, you know, and the other piece of it, which becomes the challenge when you're talking about prescription drug plans. And so, you know, if we talk about in the Medicare Advantage space, right? So, you know, normally we're talking about Part A, the $953 million review, and the unimplemented recommendation was specific to duplicate payments being made for Part D and Part A, which is the hospital piece of the insurance. But this is certainly applicable in the Medicare Advantage space also, because it's going to be similar in that sense. And, you know, the problem is that because the Part D program is, you know, quasi-managed by private insurers who are PBMs, for example, right, in that sense, that some of that data sharing just inherently doesn't exist. And that's why in the Medicare Advantage space, the Medicare Advantage plans should be pulling in that prescription drug plan data to be able to make those matches to ensure that there aren't duplicate payments, because the PBMs are paying those claims on behalf of the plan sponsor, which in the case of Medicare Advantage is going to be whoever the primary holder of the Medicare Advantage policy is. And so you sometimes are going to have that. But even when you talk about Part A, the problem is a data sharing issue, is that when that Part D claim is being processed, it's being processed by a PBM, which is separate and apart from Part A, which is traditional Medicare, which would be a MAC, a Medicare Administrative Contractor, paying it. So, you know, a little bit of the issue is not even within the program, it's the fact that there isn't necessarily real-time or near real-time data, and so there isn't necessarily that inherent ability to data match in real-time or near real-time, however you're defining real-time. And so that becomes part of what that metric is. And I think, you know, the other half is when we're talking about the unimplemented recommendation of interagency coordination of benefits, you know, that's a whole other ball of wax. You know, I know that there was an instance, I was contacted a few years ago to try to put a couple of people together where there was a prepay that was put in place by an agency other than HHS, and that agency had a prepay for providers where they were denying claims and Medicare was the secondary payer, but Medicare was paying those claims. And so the question was posed to me, you know, how is that even happening? We're denying claims under our agency's program, but we're seeing that Medicare is still paying as the secondary payer. So I made some phone calls and got a couple of people together to, you know, step away. It was just introductions. But the point of it is that it kind of raises the same question, which is, how do you coordinate between interagency? How do you have that coordination and get that to go? And I think that's one of the challenges within the healthcare sphere. I mean, I think when we start to look, for example, at the PRAC, the Pandemic Response Accountability Committee, which was created as a result of the COVID money that went out, that one of the things that the PRAC is looking to do is amalgamate data that's disparate amongst agencies to identify these anomalies that exist from one government agency to another. And so maybe there is a home for a place like the PRAC where they can ingest disparate sets of data from different agencies outside of COVID and identify these instances where that may occur. You know, and see where there could be the potential for shared savings. Because remember, they're looking, when HHS OIG puts out its report on unimplemented recommendations, that's just on the HHS side, right? The VA puts out a list of them, you know, all of the IGs put out a list. So did the VA do a similar study and find that the VA had similar monies, or did the VA find even more money in dealing with other organizations, Railroad Retirement Board, Medicare, for example, or, you know, CHIP programs or Medicaid or, you know, whatever it may be. This was just a sliver, right? So those are two that kind of stand out where data matching becomes an important piece. The third one, Matt, which I want to go to you about, is the behemoth, and it's the elephant in the room. It's $4.2 billion, and it really has to do with the thing that's come to top of mind for a lot of people, which is primarily this premise of the Medicare Advantage plans and risk score adjustments and the manipulation of risk scores and, you know, the big phrases that are used are cherry picking and lemon dropping. Cherry picking meaning that you're picking people that are not sick and don't have a lot of comorbidities and cost the program very little, and lemon dropping meaning that the people with all the comorbidities are getting dropped one for one reason or another. But the $4.2 billion that's out there is directly the result of some audits that have been done showing some changes in the risk scores and things of that sort. And we're seeing there are multiple key TAMs that have been put out about risk score, you know, issues and things of that sort. And I know, you know, when we look back at our time when we went through training on Medicare Advantage, when at the time it was known as Medicare Part C or Medicare Choice Plus or whatever the name is, but it's really Medicare Advantage. It's the HMO of Medicare, pluses and minuses to joining it. You know, some areas in the country have very high Medicare Advantage enrollment. At one time, Puerto Rico was the number one in the country, 93% or 94%. I forget what state now has now taken that over, but it's no longer Puerto Rico. But, you know, the one thing that always stands out is that when you look at the issues involving this $4.2 billion, a lot of it comes back to the fact that there are key TAMs that have been filed. There are a number of cases going on involving a number of payers involving this. But ultimately, Matt, what it comes down to is from the plan side, the payer side, it's making sure that your risk scoring is accurate, it's correct, that, you know, policies are in place to ensure that it's a positive way of looking at it. I can tell you, I have looked at some of the CMS guidance and regulations. Sometimes it's not all that clear. And so some of the policies I think that OIG seems to identify in risk score adjustment, a lot of it has to do with tightening policies, creating a better policy. How far is the look back period? What are going to be considered? What's not considered? Things of that sort. But it ultimately comes down to having current strong policies from the Medicare Advantage plan perspective that mirror what CMS's guidance is, and that even in the absence of guidance, plans should take maybe a little bit more of a conservative approach. That $4.2 billion number is humongous, to say the least.
Yeah, you think about the history of Medicare Advantage with CMS. I mean, it was basically an afterthought for, 20 years. When we were there, early 90s, there was very little oversight of the HMOs, because the percentage of beneficiaries that were using HMOs rather than traditional Medicare was very low. Those percentages have been going up every year, because it's probably, a lot of the benefits being advertised by these choice plans, go beyond traditional Medicare. They get the drugs, they get the payer card with, $150 a month or whatever it may be for over-the-counter drugs and things like that. So beneficiaries are joining it a lot more than they used to. So we're in, right now, I believe it's about 50% of the Medicare beneficiaries are members of these, Medicare Advantage plans. That percentage is kind of leveled off, but the numbers of beneficiaries go up every year as the numbers of overall beneficiaries go up. So that $4.2 billion is not out of the ordinary for this type of activity, because the amount of money being spent by Medicare for HMO or Medicare Advantage plans has gone up astronomically in recent times. So looking at that, I don't believe that the policies in place, the oversight of the plans, has caught up with that. I think there's one oversight, UPIC medic that looks at Part D nationwide. It's not possible to look at these things. And you see with the numbers of QUITAMs that are being filed and the criminal complaints that are being filed against some of these plans for falsifying the diagnoses or giving a comorbidity that gives a higher risk score. It's out there, it's prevalent. We just haven't caught up with it yet on oversight, on policy, or on enforcement.
Well, Matt, that kind of begs the question, but what we traditionally see in healthcare fraud related or compliance related policy is that the rules, the laws, the policies, the guidance is always behind the curve, right? We see fraud schemes come up and then everybody rings the bell and says, oh, we have to have a policy on this because we are behind the curve to some extent. Some of it is not by our own knowledge. Like, you see right now skin substitutes, right? Becoming a huge problem. And we're behind the curve, because at the time, who would have ever thought that putting out a skin substitute and having a legitimate policy in place that says you must have, stage 3 pressure ulcers, other things have to fail, other traditional therapies, and then all of a sudden providers are coming up with workarounds on how to still get paid for things in an off-label manner or in a way to circumvent the policy. We see it all the time with things like that. We see it with the amniotic fluid, the injections, right, for knees and joints and things of that sort. So we tend to be behind the curve. But remember, when Medicare Advantage was first put out there, I think it came out in 1997-ish or so, mid-90s. When it came out, remember that the colloquial conversation was there is no fraud in Medicare Part C or Medicare Advantage because it's capitated payments. And certainly anybody who would have thought that there was fraud would have been of the feeling that the fraud of today doesn't affect the provider or the fraud schemes of today. It's tomorrow, right? Because you're making those adjustments for tomorrow's payments, not today's payments. And certainly no one thought that the Medicare Advantage plans would be embroiled in these cases, whether right, wrong, or indifferent. No one ever thought that the payers were going to be part of where some of these problems some of these problems exist. And so everything becomes an evolution and a learning curve. I mean, I remember when Medicare Part D came into effect in 2006. Remember, before Medicare Part D came into play, we didn't care if there was fraud in the pharmacy space because that was a Medicaid problem or commercial payer problem. And then all of a sudden in 2006, when Part D came into play, we all had to figure it out and learn what exactly, how did Medicare Part D work? What were the policies? How do you work on these cases? And you were kind of building the plane while it was being flown for a long time. And it took many years for everybody to kind of get up to speed. I think that now people are becoming much more conversant in how these cases work, Medicare Advantage, how the schemes work on the provider side, how the risk score adjustment things work on the payer side. You know, there's a whole other set of calculations, including, you know, something that they call the MLR, medical loss ratio, right? Where the payers have to spend at least 85% or something like that on the costs on care for the patients. And when that number goes below, there's ramifications on the CMS side for that, right? And so there's a whole bunch of collateral things that I think people are still looking to learn from an actuarial perspective and all of that. That becomes the challenge. And so the question becomes, from a data perspective and analytics perspective, as a Medicare Advantage plan, or even in a non-Medicare Advantage plan, where you're in an HMO, and that HMO is paying capitated payments based upon comorbidities and, you know, the health of the people, which is where you get a little bit more of that cherry picking and the lemon dropping, is, are your algorithms right? Have they been empirically tested for accuracy? And that's where you get these instances of third-party audits that, you know, you want to make sure, is your third-party auditor doing, you know, a good job? What's your error rate? How are you calculating those error rates? And, you know, do you have an issue with, do you have an issue with the way that those audits are being done? You know, what is the methodology in some regard? You know, in the Medicare Advantage space, they talk about the RADV audit, and the RADV audit includes there, it's a statistically valid sample. They use 201 records as the platform, you know, for that. You know, we have a tool here. We do these RADV audits where we have these people kind of implicitly involved in that. But there's a learning curve, right, that has to be part of that metric. And so, you know, I think the piece of it is, when we look at these unimplemented recommendations from a, you know, from a not even a fraud, waste, abuse perspective, but from a compliance, a policy, but even a guidance perspective, CMS is putting out, in the OIG in particular, on these unimplemented recommendations, are putting out guidance on the unimplemented recommendations, how to fix some of these issues. So from a payer perspective, this is where looking at that information is going to be helpful, right? Policy-wise, OIG is saying, hey, payers, here are the issues, here's how you fix them. So, you know, Matt, that's where you get your, you know, that's where your payment integrity, your policy people, your medical direction all have to be in the same room, look at these unimplemented recommendations, and it's, you know, like, what say you?
Right. And if you look at the history of Medicare, let's talk about Part A and managed care. You know, how is this different from a hospital upcoding their DRGs? It's not. It happens every day. And we know it's happening. It's just more difficult to detect, more difficult to investigate than traditional professional Part B services, where it's either rendered or not rendered. You look at a medical record, you talk to the patient. There's more complexities to it. The investigators need to catch up on how to do these types of investigations. The algorithms, the models, all of that need to be fine-tuned to find those outliers, both, you know, with the DRGs and with the Medicare Advantage HRAs and all of that. And it's just, you're right, it's all catch up. And then what comes down to is that it's training of the investigators and all that to investigate those things. For the payers, right, what's the incentive? If they're not going to get caught, what's the incentive for them to follow the guidelines when they've been getting, you know, getting these profits, $4.2 billion, and no one said boo?
Right, right. And so, Wade, that brings up a great point, and I want to give you the last word as we wrap up, is, you know, these are very complicated cases, and this is one of those instances where investigators really need to coordinate with the auditors that are doing this HCC, as they call it, the risk score. These are typically people that are CPC trained or CRC trained, right, revenue cycle and things of that sort. But, you know, understanding the medical record in totality and doing these reviews, as an investigator, we can't make heads or tails of them, because it's, you're ultimately giving someone a diagnosis that's going to result in a risk score adjusted, you know, code, which is going to determine what those capitated payments are. But for that last word, this is one of those things where you can have all the training in the world as an investigator, but you got to be able to coordinate, speak, and coordinate and work with the people that understand the chart itself from that documentation perspective. You can't be an island on these cases because they are so different than your traditional, we'll call it the pro fee, or your typical CPT or HCPCS related cases.
Right. Recently with Advise, I was involved with some HCC RADV audits, and it was not having any experience that as an OI agent. It was Greek to me. It was not anything that I had experience with. So that's the area where you have to, it's not that you have to know everything, but you have to have the Rolodex of people to go to, whether it be someone in Office of Audit, you know, going back to the government days, OE&I, whatever, with the commercial payer. It's a matter of knowing who to go to. It's you're not expected to know everything. You can't possibly know everything, but you have to have the resources to be able to reach out and either have somebody speak to it. It's the same thing with data. We can't know everything about data. You might need a data scientist, but have somebody who can either speak to it or bring you up to speed if it's not so complex that it's the learning curve is too high. Either bring you up to speed or have someone to address those issues directly who has that experience.
Right. Yeah, and that's the challenge. But this lends itself very much to the conversation that we incessantly have, which is that you can't work your cases on an island. You need to coordinate with your overall payment integrity people, your auditors, your policy people, your claims processing people. You have to be able to have these conversations with everyone, you know, to see where it is. But, you know, for those out there that are, you know, looking at these, if you look at the work plan, you got to look at these unimplemented recommendations, because as we talked about last week, they are symbiotic documents. They go hand in hand. And again, not to make a political statement at all, but $13 billion in unimplemented recommendations, that's real money. And there are going to be instances where some of those recommendations that are not implemented, there's a reason for not implementing them, and everybody who's involved will have an opinion about why they shouldn't have been implemented, and there'll be a counter argument about why they should have been implemented, and it's just a battle of wills in some regard about why you agree or disagree with the premise in the OIG's assertions. Obviously, the OIG believes that if they put out a report, they believe this should be implemented, right? So we know OIG's position, but you really need to read what the organization that is targeted in that particular report, why they disagree in whole or in part with those recommendations, because there may be pieces of the puzzle that OIG either didn't catch, don't agree, you know, don't understand, or whatever it may be. So it's not always a black and white response. There may be a little bit more of a twist to it to understand where that dollar amount is and what that dollar amount is vis-a-vis those policies. So, you know, it's interesting. We'll address more of these as we go on, because the work plan is constantly updating for people that know this. The work plan is constantly having items added to it, and the work plan is constantly having items resolved as OE&I, Office Evaluation Inspections, and OAS, Office of Audit Services, complete their reviews and their studies and identify program weaknesses or program efficiencies. Remember, OIG isn't always there just to ding the 300 different operating divisions. They're there in some regards to identify areas of improvement and also ways to create shared savings and individualized savings. So it's an interesting premise. The unimplemented reports are out there. You can do a lot of searching. You can search by type of report. You could search on dollar amount. You could search on program. The website's very interactive, so we do encourage people to take a look at that. So we'll leave it at that. We'll leave the unimplemented recommendations. We're done. Two-parter discussing it. There's a lot of stuff out there. There's a lot to chew on. So if you're interested in seeing what else is out there, other OIGs also have their unimplemented recommendations. And so it's worth looking at kind of the global. I mean, if you look at OIGs overall, one of their watchdogs, and that's their job, is to find where there are fraud, waste, abuse, and compliance weaknesses that could be implemented to create savings or claw back money that the programs that they're looking at feel have been unceremoniously collected, and that there should be more ceremoniousness in, if that's even a word, in collecting that money. Matt being the grammar police, I'm sure that he will let me know whether or not that's a word or not. So
I'll read the transcript
as always. And get back to what's
you.
That?
I'll read the transcript and send
let me know, of course. I don't know whether or not my participle is danging or if I used proper a-restrictive, a-restrictive positive. Where's my apostrophe? I know you'll let me know of that. In your next life, I'm sure you're going to be a professor of English.
Bartleby the Scrivener. That's me.
Yeah. And again, just go out and buy that book. Shrunken White.
Elements. I have it in style. The next room. You want me to? I'll
send you a copy. It's a great guide for those that are functionally illiterate on how to write a sentence. Great book. So, as always, gents, good seeing you. Good talk. For those that continue to tune in and participate, we appreciate your time. For those that were at NHCA, hope you got to see some of our folks walking around and got to say hello and have coffee and see what the story is. But as always, we thank everybody for joining us. And again, you can get the newsletter every Friday to your inbox. Just go up onto the website, sign up for the newsletter, catch our podcasts on our Spotify and our YouTube channel every week, and our LinkedIn Lives every month. We put those up after they broadcast. So as always, we enjoy spending time with everyone. I enjoy spending my time with you guys. And until next time, we'll see you on the next OIG Roundtable. Take care, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone.